Bye-bye. Alexandra, nice to see you again. How have you been?
Guten Tag.
Bonjour. How have you been?
Well, a bit busy, just like most of us, aren't we?
Under the circumstances, we're doing pretty good. Let me quickly introduce you, but I think maybe you're going to probably have to add a few things. Professor Alexandra Henriot-Cotte is a geneticist and RNA expert, founder of the Simplicissima Research Institute. And she's going to tell us things about what we don't know and what we underestimate about these mRNA vaccines. There are common misconceptions like the RNA is not incorporated into the genome and is not passed on to the next generation. These are fatal assumptions, you're saying.
Well, to the limit that they haven't been counterproved, yes, they are. So the question remains. So it's more of a question and risks that I raise, and surprises that given the month of administration, we still are profoundly lacking a number of answers. Mm-hmm. So if we are to step back a little, I stood up quite early, being not really happy and excited about the fact that we were shifting into a uniquely policy uniquely based on vaccination against coronavirus. And the reason being that there had never been any approved, at least in France, I can't talk on all the countries, but in France, we had never had any approved anti-coronavirus vaccination for any coronaviruses. And it has been quite a lot of energy put into the research, the reason being that coronaviruses are very well known in veterinarian world. Mm-hmm. And therefore, those who work and those who read the papers knew in advance that it was very risky business to go into a vaccination against coronavirus. The idea of still trying, I think, was worth it, because one has always, you know, to take a ticket and to try, because it's a new virus. But we had to be really, really cautious, which we haven't been at all, to say the least. Mm-hmm. So this is the first thing. And therefore, there was this article that I really liked quite early, saying that if we were to use vaccination, then we ought to ask to make a specific requirement of an informed consent, just because it was an anti-coronavirus. So it was informed consents are usually a common practice, but on top of this informed consent, those scientists were begging that we would be we would add a specific specific limitation in the informed consent into explaining to the people the risk of ADE and ERD, ADE being antibody-dependent enhancements. So this risk that the antibodies, instead of doing the job that one wants them to do, which is neutralizing the virus, will rather facilitate the entry of the virus in the cell. That was one, and the other was the enhanced respiratory disease. We don't know how much of this mechanism overlap one another, but the fact is that we had observed in animal models that when using an anti-coronavirus vaccination, we were to increase the respiratory disease and to worsen the condition. So at least this informed consent should have been raised to the public awareness, saying, you know, you may be at higher risk of worsening your disease, which hasn't been done at all. So that was the first consent that I had. The second one was the second warning, if I could say, was that we were using completely new technologies. So we had the choice between vaccine based on genetically modified organisms. Those are typically AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Sputnik. So all those vaccines are based on a recombinant technology that leads to creating a GMO, which is in turn being used as the trigger for our immune system. The other classification was this mRNA injection. And there are many reasons why I think it was, we shouldn't have been using the word vaccine. Indeed, I and others had been using the word mRNA vaccine in our field, in our community. But I think that it was rather to coin a name that was simple for the people for us in our community to understand. And we all knew, because we are in the science field, that if we were to call them mRNA vaccine, that didn't mean that they were acting as a vaccine. The problem is, again, once you go out to the public. And once you go out to the public, one wishes the public to properly understand, and especially the MDs who are doing the injection, to properly understand what is the product they are facing, because it is a brand new technology that had not been used. We have faced a number of fake information, sorry. Typically, that mRNA technology was very well known, very spread, and all this bullshit, if I may. Because actually, one of your researchers put a list together of all the mRNA vaccine clinical trials, and it was altogether, it has been 70 clinical trials using mRNA, 53 being just on COVID-19. So a very limited amount, I should find the papers, a very limited amount. So that means 17 only performed on other diseases, such as infectious diseases or cancer. And when I say that, so basically, when they said, you know, this mRNA technology has been widely used and are well known and all this thing, so we should have a look at the 13 that were declared as clinical trials, and you see that they don't go beyond phase one, two, or starting three, and then stopping. 54% of those clinical trials are to begin, so they are not haven't started yet, and 20% are ongoing. So this is just to set the cartoon to the people so that they really understand that we are not only on a product that we do not know of, but also a technology that we cannot claim to being to masterize, because there haven't been any approved mRNA vaccine, if we call them vaccine, today.
And how these former studies that were not related to COVID-19, which years are they? Are they really like, is it an old thing that was kind of given up already, or?
We have been using, there is an excellent review paper in the journal Vaccines by Margaret Liu, dating from 2019. And she goes with a comparison between those technology that are using DNA and those using mRNA. And she basically proves that it hasn't been a great success thus far. And I am very sad to declare that because as you have introduced Rainer in the little notice about myself, I've been choosing the part of RNA for the last 15 years, I think. So I do believe in the potency of RNA to cure, to be a diagnostic tool, to have great potency to help us. And yet it hasn't been a success. So the very first trial with mRNA has been in 1992, to answer precisely your point, by a study of Bloom and colleagues. And then little by little, they really tried different formulation because they saw that the mRNA was really yielding to big response in the immune system, but like too much. And so they formulated this liposome, so this encapsulation, so that one would get more success. And little by little, they did a number of changes on this technology to the very point of this product, which have also very new things, such as specific lipid nanoparticles that hadn't been used yet, so that we were not very familiar with. And the other thing was using a genetic code that is completely unknown. So this is work from Carrico, and she had been showing that if we were to use some pseudo-uridylation, we would yield to more success in terms of stability and of increased translational capacity. So meaning if we talk with a simple word, we would say increased stability and increased productivity. But this time they systematically change every U into this pseudo uridylation, and this is completely unknown. So it's an unknown genetic code on top of that that we are throwing into ourselves. So to come back, oops, excuse me. I don't know if you can hear that, but oh, sorry.
It's really very irritating and frightening.
I'm sorry?
It's very frightening what you say, you know, like, I mean.
So I like to remain always positive. So maybe it's good news, but unfortunately, what we see is in terms of the secondary effects is really, really bad. So yeah, it is. I think the frightening part of what I say is really in the terms of new thing tested for the very first time. New anti-coronavirus vaccine, because never approved yet. New mRNA vaccine, because never approved for any other condition yet. New genetic code, never used before, and so therefore we have many questions and thus far no answers to those questions, to the best of my knowledge. I always like to state that it is to the best of my knowledge, because one can miss something and one has to always be really cautious, which I try to be each time. So this is, I believe, why. So this thing with the vaccine word is important to understand, and it has actually been caught by the public attention, because what vaccine do you know of that when you are vaccinated for the first 2 weeks, let's say, you are called non-vaccinated. So if people think that I'm making a bad case with this wording, I think they should just have a little step backward and say, hey, yeah, I've never heard about such product that you call it a vaccine or you call yourself vaccinated only after a couple of, 10 to 15 days after getting the jab. And the reason is clear. It's because you need those additional steps that gives you that are requested by the mRNA injection. What are these additional steps? It is that once injected, you need the time for your immune system to realize that it is facing a vaccine, because the lipid nanoparticle make the product to enter the cell. So your immune system is not really aware that there is this issue. And then it's only after you really get to produce the mRNA into a protein and the protein to go at the surface of the cell that suddenly your immune system sort of realize that this looks like a viral protein and therefore you ought to have an immune response. So those additional steps were completely squeezed in the public awareness. The medical doctors have no clue about those steps. For them, it really is as if it was a vaccine, meaning you inject and you get your immune system to face the spike protein and therefore to react. The companies were perfectly aware of this limitation as to call them vaccine, because Moderna itself, and I went onto the webpage yesterday, so they still haven't changed it. It says, welcome to Moderna. We believe mRNA is the software of life. And then they go on saying that, every cell in the body uses mRNA to provide real-time instructions to make the proteins necessary to drive all aspects of biology, including in human health and disease. Given its essential role, we believe mRNA could be used to create a new category of medicine, I mean, they don't say that they have the thing ongoing and that it is proved with significant potential to improve the lives of patients. We are pioneering a new class of medicines. So they themselves say a new class of medicines. They don't say a new class of vaccines mm-hmm. made of messenger RNA. And they go on. I mean, I really prompt you and others to go on the Moderna website. You just type Moderna and software of life, and you will end up on their website. They may change it, but this is just to show you that I'm not making a fuss on this name for fake. And in my idea, the best classification in the European Medicine Agency that could more tailor what we were using is the ATMP classification. The ATMP classification is about advanced technology medicinal products. And they fall under a different jurisdiction. And I believe that had we pinpoint that since the very early beginning, we would never have been in the capacity to release it to the wide public, whether emergency status or not was declared, because those fall under very specific jurisdiction. So we are dealing with a medicinal product with advanced technology, and we are dealing with a specific modification, which is an augmentation, because you are not replacing a gene that it was deficient. You are not repairing a gene that was deficient. You are adding to your cells and new information. this augmentation is really the philosophy of the transhumanism ideas of augmenting the people. So it is actually, on top of everything, it is, I believe, the very first time we use an augmentation broadly to the public without bringing his understanding or their one's understanding. What else that I have to say? So,
augmentation, you mean not like making better, but actually adding something onto it that adds a new functionality, basically.
But exactly.
It improves us, right? Behind closed doors, they're thinking that they're improving us, but only in their favor.
I'm sorry, excuse me, because I'm being distracted. I'm sorry.
This augmentation, what does it really mean? Does it mean, this is the first time that they're adding something. They're not replacing.
Correct. And that is why I don't like the word gene therapy, because gene therapy is a bit misleading as well. Gene therapy means you are treating the person. You are not treating any healthy person. And unfortunately, those injections could have led to be prophylactic, to be treating the patients, but they are not. They were not designed to do so, and so therefore they are not. So it's not proper. It's again a bit misleading to call them gene therapy, and that's why the only name I can think of is experimental gene injection. It's quite straightforward. This is exactly what we are doing. And so to come back to your to this thing of augmentation of adding an information, I really feel that the best way to explain the people is to use the example of a tomato. Because when you, it's very strange, but I realize after talking to so many people that if you talk about them, to talk to them about a human being, they get lost very easily. Now, if you externalize the idea, they follow it very easily. So we take this tomato, we take this syringe that has an mRNA in the lipid particle, and you inject the tomato, expecting the thing that you inject, the nanoparticle, to fuse with the cells of the tomato and to have the mRNA entering the tomato. And I should stress that this mRNA is not from a tomato species. It is from another species. So it is an information from a totally remote species, typically a viral species. And so you have now your tomato, which is entitled to, which has the capacity to be producing a viral protein. How do you call this tomato? A genetically modified organism. And it is so much easier to understand it on a tomato as to understand it on us. Yet it is the exactly same process. it probably doesn't fall under the same jurisdiction. I believe that if you do a GMO tomato, you will have much more trouble than you do doing it with human. But this is something of your expertise and not mine. But
it's bizarre. It's bizarre.
Yeah, that's the way it is. So you cannot play with words, and you have to make the people understand that they accept to be genetically modified. So just by the fact that they have this mRNA in their cells that is hijacking their machinery, because it is designed to be extremely efficient to be produced It's given this new genetic code, and your machinery was maybe building protein that really needed to be built at the time that it entered the message entered the cell, but yet given the very very precise and fantastic modification of this mRNA, it is prompted to translate this mRNA. Now, the question is, so you are modified. How is it going to modify your whole, what we call epigenetic? So any sort of RNA molecules has a great versatility of interaction. RNA molecules can interact with DNA and can interact with protein and can interact with RNA. The way I, as a professor, I've been repeatedly explaining RNA to students, and the way I was explaining it is, I was saying, you have a cell phone. The DNA would be the instruction of your cell phone. The proteins will be any sort of component of your cell phone, the microphone, the screen. And in between, you need to connect those two. So you need the network connection. This is the RNA. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the network connection has the capacity of interacting widely and to be extremely powerful in changing the interaction. How is it going to change it? In different cell types of different tissue, in different individuals, at different ages, all that at different condition, all that is completely unknown and has to be different from one another. So it is really opening a box that we have no idea of how it's gonna react. Now
I have a question.
Wait.
The producers, they say that the mRNA only is active for a very short time and then it's destructed afterwards and it's no longer there. What do you think about that?
I don't think anything. I want to see the proof of that. I want to see I like to say that I'm a very stupid scientist because I just want to see the proof of that. Mm-hmm. So they keep on saying that it gets degraded. So I have to say that I'm a bit surprised because all the technology was and this genetic code that Carrico designed was specifically made so that it would be extremely stable. So I'm surprised that it gets degraded just like any other mRNA. Mm-hmm. So it's like, so there is something that doesn't go in my mind. And now, of course, it's a contradiction. And now I want to have the evidence. I still haven't found the paper that shows me that this specific mRNA that is being injected to billions at billions times is degraded with this timing and in all cells, because also you know that all cells are different, and so is it degraded the same way in the different cell types? How is it degraded? And then once it is degraded, what does the pseudo-uridylated residue become? You know, what because it's a great load of them. What are they gonna do? Because the pseudo-uridylation is a normal phenomenon in cells, in human and in animals, but that is really tailored to a specific regulation, very complex with a different storage of the molecules and all that. So we do have mRNA that is pseudo-uridylated, but those mRNA that gets pseudo-uridylated gets the pseudo-uridylation, the modification, only at hotspot. And so the rest, the remaining, remains the same. So we do not know something that is completely changed. Have I answered your question, Wolfgang?
Yes, thank you. So yes. You just said you don't know.
I want to know. I said more than that. I want to see.
Nobody knows.
I said I want to see. I want to see the proof. And I don't. I can't stand it anymore that people keep on repeating and all these poor medical doctors that explain to their patients that it gets degraded and have absolutely no clue because we don't have the proof of it now. So I worry about gene modification. I worry about the inheritance of this modification. We don't know, again. So there are two kind, now we go into a second detail. So we briefly alluded to the epigenetic modification, which is that the fact that the whole interaction network of your cell is being changed. Is it going to lead to changes that are inherited, that can be inherited? We don't know, but it may be very likely because a great load of epigenetic modification gets inherited. And when they get inherited, they can appear in the next generation or in other generations, sometimes jumping generations. So this is extremely complex regulatory level. The other more simple to understand level is this RNA going to be reverse transcribed to be DNA? So you go backward, so the RNA becomes DNA, and if it becomes DNA, it has the capacity to go into the nucleus. And if it goes into the nucleus, it has the capacity to integrate the genome. And since what we know thus far is that the particle that we have injected do go into the ovary and the testis, I raise the question of the possibility that this occur in our germ cells and therefore can be transmitted in the next generation. So this is a very troublesome thing. And that I think that no one can be selfish enough as to say, you know what, I just need my pass, I just need my job. And whether it will change the next generation, I don't really care. Because this is a human concern for humanity. This is very unheard of, and it is a totally new page that we are opening. Now, the question is, can this scenario take place? Because I've read on and on by big organisms that it doesn't take place, that RNA cannot go ultimately cannot be reverse transcribed and cannot go to the nucleus to be integrated. This is false to say that it cannot. The reason being that the very best pioneer on the matter of viral sequence integration in our human genome is Rudolf Jainisch. Rudolf Jainisch has been working on those topics since 1970. I wasn't even born, or almost. So he has been publishing a paper stating that SARS-CoV-2 genome had the capacity of being reverse transcribed naturally by our cells by what we call endogenous reverse transcriptases. So when we say endogenous, that means that we already have in our cells the capacity of through line one sequence, so I'm becoming very technical, but sequences that we have provide the capacity of producing our own reverse transcriptase and to eventually have the RNA to turn to DNA. And he has gone to show in cells the case that they do integrate the human genome. So the question is here fully raised by this work. This work was concerning only the SARS-CoV-2 genome, but now we need to know what happens with the RNA that we are being injecting. So that of course, that leads to the the idea that it will maybe be inherited. There's, the other way of inherit, I just want to finish, please remember your question.
Yes.
The other way it can be inherited is when the pregnant women are being injected, because this mRNA, this capsule can go into can go through the placenta and reach the fetuses, whatever the stage is. And in embryonic stem cells, in embryonic cells, we have a great load of this reverse transcriptase active. So the chances are, the chances that if the mRNA reaches a little baby that is in under construction, that it integrates their the genome of the baby cells is actually, I believe, really high. So this is another way of inheritance, not reaching the germ cells, but the baby itself in the uterus. Sorry, Wolfgang.
So I was thinking of the fact that mostly we don't have only one virus coming, but we have different virus we are hosting in our cells. And so we have viruses with the transcriptase, and we have you know, when we see there is herpes, there is HIV, there is all those viruses existing, which have different possibilities, and perhaps they exchange their possibilities and they interfere with each other. So this is, I think, another thing we have to think of.
Yeah, of course. Another source of reverse transcriptase, not only our own genomic one by the retrotransposons such as LINE1, is all the retroviruses, typically, as you named it, HIV, herpes, or another kind of viruses that nobody talks about, but that because they don't give any clinical signs, are the spuma viruses. And spuma, foamy viruses, also called spuma or foamy, are don't give clinical signs, and therefore nobody knows at which stage we have those foamy viruses in our cells. So this is again a maybe silent yes. way of having.
I think it is good to explain this with herpes, because we have the herpes virus all our lives. And, you know, all those people getting zoster and getting the problems with herpes viruses all their life again and again and again. They know that there is a virus. They host them all the time. And so there may be interactions between this.
And so now,
can I ask if we'd be looking at some of these DNA, whatever, you know, inscription, or like adding to the cells, like what kind of changes could we possibly be looking at? I mean, would this be people with like three kidneys, or like, you know, like really like organ changes, like 10 eyes, or who knows? Or is it really just like affecting like interior cell interior activities that go on, you know, like whatever, like thrombosis things, or like other aspects of effects to the immune system, or like, or could it be, you know, that we all of a sudden can tolerate radioactivity much better, or that we can breathe underwater, or like, I mean, it's
less better.
Or be smarter than we are, or be more beautiful than we are.
So we can expect anything, right?
So I obviously I do not have the answer to your excellent question, but we have knowledge of what has been taking place for other viruses sequences, and for other viruses sequences we know that other RNA viruses have been integrated in our genome. This phenomenon is not so rare, because at least 8% of our genome is composed of those viral sequences. And from what we have observed and what we sort of understand is that it seems as though the integration of those viral sequences is again regulated. So they don't go anywhere in the genome. They get some kind of hotspot where they tend to go, and usually they are going under the risk of oncogenicity, so the risk of developing cancer. So what I would tend to expect just on the basis of what we have known for years is a rather enhancing, increasing the number of cancer.
Mm-hmm. You know this work from Umeå in Stockholm, the two scientists who were publishing just now, yes. Just some weeks ago.
I will talk about it. Yeah,
That the repair mechanism is perhaps damaged.
Yeah. So I just want to remain general, and then we will go on to two issues remain on the floor: cancerogenicity, fertility, safety, and pregnant women. And for cancerogenicity, I wish to go back to the paper you just mentioned, Wolfgang. So the third, the one aspect, gene modification; second aspect, inheritance of the modification; and third aspect that I've constantly been asking to lawyers without getting satisfactory answer, at least for my little brain, is the patentable modification. Are those modifications that we are to that are taking place, as I mentioned, in a very straightforward manner with the tomato, can the company be patenting them, saying that actually I am typically a unique sample of a specific modification that took place in my cells, have I been injected with Pfizer or Moderna, and how, or even AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson, not to say that they don't have the capacity of yielding modification as well. And so can the company claim that I am patentable? I don't know.
We don't think so. I don't think so. There's one particular decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that many people point to, but I read through it and it does not contain such language. I don't think that is possible.
So this is, to me, again, you know, it's like, I don't think it's possible. I like more heavy substance to be sure that it cannot take place.
I just do not think it is, meaning, no, it can't. It can't.
This would be the reinvention of slavery.
Yes, that's what it would be. You cannot patent human beings. I know, if you take the example of the tomato, that's a different story, but it's not a human being. The big question is, and that's a medical question again, does this genetic intervention, does this change us into something that's not human anymore? I don't think so. I don't think so. If it does, that's a different story, but I really don't think so.
So it, that does change you in the sense that now you have this viral information, very specific viral information because of the genetic modification of the pseudouridylation. So of course, we will remain human, but human change human, and therefore, I think that once you have this modification, you may patent.
I I have looked at this question a number of times, and the only way that I can imagine that a human being can be a patented thing, not a human anymore, is by separating the human body and brain from the emotions, the capacity to have empathy. I do think that if that is what they want, then we do not have humans anymore. Then we only have robots. Those can be patented, yes.
Sure. Sounds good. That means
life is communication.
Yeah.
And we communicate within us in the cell. We communicate, the cells communicate. And this, I have a question, was exosome and mRNA. I don't want to forget it. And so we have lots of ways to communicate. And we agree on things when we say we are a human being. We say the monkeys are no human beings. So there is some difference. I think it's just a matter of communication, and the communication is flowing all the time through everything that communicates with what is life. And we have to arrange, and we function as we function. And if someone changes this, if you invent a new language, if we speak in a different language, we will change.
No.
I will play the devil's advocate just for a little moment. Now I take a different aspect. Great monkeys are, there is this discussion that great monkeys will be called human because they are so elaborated in their communication, as you said. And the question is being raised nowadays. And so if we reach this, the status where the great monkeys are you know, called human, then
citizens of our society. Yeah,
called, I don't know how they will coin the classification. Then the question remains, I think. But anyway, so if we go back to the floor. Cancerogenicity. So exosomes. Exosome is an excellent thing as well. So it's another word that may sound difficult, but it's very easy. It's because cells do need a lot of communication, and one mean. So you have the hormones typically to be in the capacity of communication at long distance. So the Wi-Fi, amongst the Wi-Fi communication, you have exosomes. Mm-hmm. And exosomes are a little bit of the of lipids, of the membrane lipids, that will take some typically RNA molecules, and that will bring them to a distance to an organ or a tissue, specific cell type or whatever. So this is, again, a great source of communication and mm-hmm. a great source of having these exosomes with the RNA flooding, with the mRNA probably flooding and reaching out any sort of cells potentially.
And do you think it's possible that the exosomes, they go into the mucosa? Can they be transported from one human being to the next human being as the virus? The virus.
So I've been working on exosomal purification techniques, and so yes, in the different fluida. So we were modeling the urine. But saliva is definitely. I mean, I should look up. I didn't upgrade my the literature on the topic, but I think, to the best of my knowledge, you had exosomes in the saliva. So yes, I mm-hmm. can export it in the different fluids, I believe, mm-hmm. and transpiration as well.
Are they recognized by the immune system? Sure. If you transport them to a different human being, but when you kiss someone and you
treat, will exosome. I do not believe we have a signature because of those molecules, because they are basic lipid membranes. So I do not think that they, but I may be wrong, because the fact that they are quite well regulated means that they have maybe in their composition of the lipid, or they may have some signals. So I have to be cautious. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So now, cancerogenicity. So we did, I hope you are aware, Rainer, because I think I had sent it to you. We did a little exchange with the EMA, the mm-hmm. European Agency, on cancerogenicity. We wrote to them, asking them, hey, guys, what are you say you claim the product is safe. Everyone claimed the product is safe. So how safe is it in terms of cancerogenicity? What can you show us? And the answer was is on the website of pose2think.org. So pose, in one word, pose2think, pose and the figure two, and then think, pose2think.org. And you have all our letter and their response. Basically, their response was petrifying. They were saying, you know, what do you expect us to do? You know, it's like it takes time and human resource and money. And so we are not going to do those kind of study.
We don't have any time to worry about this. We'll find out later when everyone dies of cancer. Okay, that's a good answer.
That's a good, I thought that was a very brilliant scientific answer. And I have to say that the quality of the answer was absolutely appalling. I mean, we are used to having this ping pong communication between scientists. And we do our best to answer, you know, for any sort of publication. We have this ping pong and they criticize us and we advocate for such and such, and we elaborate why we think this is there is a rationale or there is not. And here it was awful, awful. And the other thing that they raised was that they had put this nanoparticle lipid that they didn't really masterize, and that may be leading to cancer. But in fact, they were using so little quantity of it, and they were only going to inject twice. But this has changed. Yes. So
this has definitely changed.
So the answer is, so that's the answer. So I think it's, is, I mean, if I were a lawyer, it seems to me that this letter is really
important. It's very important. We're going to have to, did you forward this to Renate Holzeisen already?
It's actually on the website,
okay.
So I didn't.
I'll tell her to look, because she's continuing with her fight against the European Commission.
Mm-hmm. So another additional reason why one should worry as to yielding to cancer is indeed this paper that from the Sweden. The Swedish team with the that you were mentioning on DNA repair. So this is a study that is performed on cell, so in vitro. So we don't know that it is taking place in vivo, but the results are so interesting and so puzzling that we need to report them, which is that with spike, you get an alteration of the capacity of DNA repair of the cells. And therefore, you get an alteration of the recombination of in our B cells for the making the power of making many antibodies, basically. Mm-hmm. And so that this is very serious again, because it paves the way for potentially an epidemic of cancer because of that. So once again, it is only in vitro, but it is very preoccupying to see that there is this alteration of the DNA repair capacity.
We did not know that the spikes enter the nucleus until they told us. They say the spikes are able, because it's a lipid also surrounding the nucleus, the spike is not only going outside presenting itself, but it's also presented inside to the nucleus. This is how, if I understood it right.
So I don't know if they have looked in the mechanism and how did I don't know. It's I wanted to be in contact with the team because I think we are lacking a number of information. So. Yeah. So this is for cancerogenicity. The other issue that I have is the fertility safety. One has to understand before we move forward that a fertility issue and COVID-19 is a worry, and similarly as has been a worry for SRAS. SARS-CoV-1, in fact. So it was not a total surprise to see that male fertility would be impaired by a coronavirus. We had seen that with SARS-CoV-1. We were sort of expecting it with SARS-CoV-2. The literature was not yield the cases that indeed it was maybe impairing, and there was this autopsy in Chinese individuals that had COVID-19, and then when we would take the testes, there was this profound changes in the tissue of the testes, and not finding the virus. So the hypothesis was it's either the consequences of the COVID-19 symptoms, such as maybe fever, or it can be the spike. So the question is raised that it can be the spike, and so at this stage we obviously do not have any sort of further insight. I like to this review. From Rajak, Rajak, and colleague, basically from India, and having this little review on understanding the crosstalk between mediators of infertility and COVID-19. The issue goes to the women with their menstrual cycle issue, with hemorrhage of the uterus and of the vagina, and of changes in all sorts of level of these menstrual cycles. The NIH finds it sufficiently interesting as to have mandated 5 universities, including Harvard, Johns Hopkins, and other universities, on the matter, as to make an understanding whether how much is due to the of this menstrual trouble are due to the injection, and second, how long do they last for. The question is not sufficient to me, because how long do they last for? The fact of having, like maybe as I see it around me, 3 or 4 cycles disappearing for in women, in young girls, it is just so unknown of and unheard of that one doesn't really know the consequences. One. Or the what happened? Why is it that for 4 or more cycles you wouldn't have your menstruation? And is it that oversight, the load of oversight that we have in our ovaries, is it impaired in any matter? How much is ongoing? We don't know.
We know that there are many microtromboses in the brain. And we have the hypophysis, we have gonadotropin. It may be some disturbance coming from the brain and not from the uterus or from the ovaria.
It could as well be, but I would say it's an addition to what we already have, because as it seems, there is a real clear local disturbance that I wouldn't... put only at the hormonal level. So I think it's, but rather at the vascular level. So I think that we, hormones are definitely a possibility of having this trouble vascular issue as well.
The level of hormones we could measure. It could easy to monitor the level of hormones.
Yeah. So this has to. This is actually something that is sort of carried along, because I've seen paper on transgender patients reacting differently in terms of their COVID-19 reaction. So they did well understand this issue with hormones, and the reason being that with the hormones, you get a regulation of the receptors to spike. So typically ACE2 is under this control, hormonal control, and so is fluctuating in the cycle. Mm-hmm. So this is, again, something that I worry. And the last one is the pregnant women. Because we know, so pregnant women, it is at the two level, the pregnant women on their pregnancy and the pregnant women on the next generation. So one is really dealing to at the level of the interaction between the woman and the baby to come. And the other is actually none of this issue, but really at the level of the future baby. So it is very clear that you have a great load of spontaneous abortion that have been raised. I like the number of 7 to 8 that have been published, because I find it quite reconcilable with all the pieces of the puzzle and the data that we have been facing. So it's enormous. That means that there is an enormous risk of terminating your pregnancy. Have you been injected? And to go back to your point earlier as to the possibility that the mRNA I lost my point.
Can I just jump in? We have heard, or I have spoken with doctors, and I've read papers, studies that say that in the meantime, if the pregnant woman gets the injection during her first trimester, then there's an 85% chance that she's going to lose the baby.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it's. But this is again very much expected, that one would get different results whether you got the injection before, in the first semester, in the first trimester, in the second, or in the third trimester, and each time you would impact differently the level. And what I was wanting to say was that. It's if you get some kind of anomaly in the of integration and therefore of your DNA, this could actually be. So you were saying, you know, maybe we have three kidneys or whatever. No, so maybe not three kidneys, or maybe. But actually, the spontaneous abortion means you have an anomaly, and in genetics we know it very well. It's a way of getting rid of the anomalies that cannot be fixed by the DNA repair capacity and all this thing. So it is a sign to me, this enormous yield of spontaneous abortion is maybe a sign of abnormal genetic variation. Mm-hmm.
And can I ask you, like, now that you, there seem to be so many things going on in with these injections at the same time, you know, with the stuff that's in them, that is it possible that you, just out of negligence or whatever, you you develop it this way, or like, for instance, deciding on this, like what you said, the replacing, you know, all this urelene or whatever with the pseudo aspect of it, is that like taking, like, you know, seeingly an extra risk? Or is this something that, you know, I mean, because it seems to be so assembled with all these different things that we don't know really about what they're going to do. Is this like, would you think that's taking, like, sort of, yeah, going for it, for the problems? Or could it be that you actually need it for some kind of extra purpose that we might not have in mind right now?
I think the question is do the facts point to the conclusion that this is being done on purpose, or is this just negligence by stupid people?
Yeah. So this goes beyond my capacity, so I will just stay at the level of science. And at the level of science, what I can say for sure is that it is impossible to understand why we took so much risk on pregnant women, not only because there was a specific concern that I had raised in the clinical trials that were designed specifically by Pfizer and other, but for Pfizer, in excluding not only the women who had the risk of becoming pregnant, but also the men who were in the capacity of having a sexual relation that could yield to a pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And when reading out this protocol, they really took specific effort to really discard each time. And when there has been accidents, if I could say it's an accident, of those who became pregnant in the process, they were withdrawn from the trial. So this is one thing. So there was this specific effort of really not taking any sort of risk of having any pregnancy. And the other part is we knew very well that there was this issue between COVID-19 and fertility. And we knew enough that we didn't know exactly how it worked. So maybe it was the spike protein, maybe it was something else, and therefore one couldn't take the risk again on the capacity of reproduction. So you know, it's just bypassing so much of knowledge that I cannot reconcile it in my mind.
Okay, this is a really clear answer. The legal analysis is that they're doing this on purpose. They're doing this on purpose. This is intent. There's no other explanation. If you're saying that it is impossible to understand why they are taking such enormous chances, one, because we know that SARS-CoV-1 and also SARS-CoV-2, of course, has the capacity to impede fertility. And then they're trying to stay away from pregnancies during the trials. It is so obvious. It is so obvious.
I don't know about it so obvious, but yeah, I mean, that's let's stay at the factual level, and that's, this is... Yeah, that's about it. That's I wanted to share with you. There is obviously much more that can be discussed. Maybe a last little hint that I want to raise is the safety in terms of the contaminants in the vials, because it keeps on being an issue that I have, unless there has been a conspiracy against Japan, which could well be, after all, you know, I'm only a scientist.
But I just
noticed that in Japan, they have been in the capacity of understanding that there were contaminants in the vials, metallic contaminants, in two companies, Pfizer and Moderna. Mm-hmm. So in Europe, how can we have had absolutely no contamination, or worse, is it that we don't check for them? Is it that we do not have the safety analysis that ensure that we have no contaminants?
No, we're not. We do have contaminants, because we have one of the experts who we spoke with is Professor Berkoff, and he explained to us that there are, he just couldn't explain why it got in there. But he says, yes, there is iron or something, some foreign material that doesn't belong in there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, and this is, this means that each country, if not at the level of Europe, should immediately stop the campaign,
yes,
make the process of being in the capacity to assess the vial, the ingredients, just like we do for any sort of process, a quality process. Mm-hmm. And then once they have set that part, then we can go maybe again, depending on the, yes, depending on how motivated we are. I am not particularly, but
yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, Alexandra, this was extremely important, because this is like a lecture. Even I'm only a lawyer, but I seem to have understood most of what you explained. I'm getting a much clearer picture of how really, really dangerous this is.
Yeah. And there is another source of contamination.
Yes.
Transmissible spongiform elements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the mad cow disease. And Pfizer do state that there is this theoretical risk that exists. So the question is open.
So the spike protein is a prion.
So I'm not saying that. I'm saying that they claim in their report that there was this theoretical risk. I mean, there was this contaminants, TSC contaminants, and that therefore there was and they acknowledge the fact that there was a theoretical risk. I can provide you this to go on page 31. Of the report made for EME, EMA, excuse me, on the adventitious agents. And so you have the documents of the EPAR report. And on page 31, you will see how they drew the attention that that the applicant has identified contamination of the product by transmissible spongiform encephalopathy agents as the main theoretical risk associated with these ingredients, and it is deemed of minimal risk.
We'll see about that. Okay.
Not to mention any prion property or that are not exclusive.
Okay.
Nothing is exclusive of one another, but it's just that we have, I like to remain at the level of the ingredients. Mm. We know about these mRNA. I told you what I know about RNA broadly, and therefore this mRNA. We know that we have this contamination, and we need to do something about it. I told you that we totally lack any information as to the cancerogenicity and the fertility issue, and yes, for the pregnant women.
I find it very important that you mentioned that those people with certain problems or gravity or want to have a baby, that they were excluded explicitly from all clinical trials. There were many people and other diagnoses excluded. But now those people who get the jab, they don't care.
Yeah, they are tailored. They seem to be targeted. Those people who were excluded at first.
Were excluded. They prioritized them. Those people who were excluded in the clinical trials now are prioritized but in the use of those jabs, and this is criminal. This is
And the reason why I was surprised with this, not surprised by the exclusion of risk of pregnancy, because this is this ought to be done in a clinical trial. But I was surprised by the number of times that they used the word. So I don't know if it was reproductive age or there were a couple of words, and the number was just enormous. And this was abnormal as compared to any other report that you could guess on the product. And that's where you go back to the idea, was it planned or not? Because they really made a special effort for
screening. Yeah, extremely.
Well, you know, I think even though we want to try with the facts, if I take all of this into account, and then I take into account the fact that the people who are behind this, including, of course, the man who owns shares in almost all of the vaccine producers, have for years targeted women for sterilization. If we take all of this into account, this cannot be a coincidence. I don't believe in such coincidences, but we'll find out. All of this is coming out now.
Can I ask one last question? Yeah. And if it's too long, the answer, then maybe you can do it in writing and we publish it or so. But I just wanted to know, like, because these companies have, you know, that are active here, have been involved in this cancer, finding a cancer treatment on this, like, vaccine basis, you know. Could it be that, you know, this way they're basically producing a lot of patients and then maybe come up with some sort of... I know it's like usually it's like targeted on the individual and like an individual gene therapy, but could it be that you could then somehow stop this process with some counter measurement, like, you know, that's another means of making money, or is this no connection?
I will repeat myself. I remain at the scientific level, and I really do not wish to go at a different level, because I will not become competent, not because I'm not curious, but not because I will not. But what is puzzling to me is the fact that they are throwing drugs against COVID that are highly mutagenic. Molnupiravir, typically, is known to be cancerogen in mammals. Mm. And this has been, it is very clear. I mean, the mutagenic aspect of these drugs that they are developing nowadays, and they are proposing, is to me puzzling, because now if you get the full picture, you use drugs against COVID-19 that are mutagenic. And then you get this injection that have, maybe because of the spike, altered your DNA repair capacity. You know the end, and you know the end result.
Wow. So really, I'm I'm going to have nightmares tonight.
Oh, man.
Oh, no. Hello, let me finish.
No, but it's good that you say all this. It has to come to the light.
We will all be dying. And the reason why we will all be dying is because we are alive. So let's take advantage of that we are alive.
That's great. Thank you very much, Alexandra.
Yeah, and the worst is not always happening and not always taking place, because the human being and living the living world is just so amazing and so full of surprise that there is loads of resilience, loads of adaptation, load of clarification by your organism. And so the worst is not always to come. So I prefer to be positive, and because the nocebo aspect of thinking that you've been injected and that you have all these people falling sick around you, and that you sort of understand that it may be linked to vaccine, is going to have a very bad effect on you, so just like the stress. Yeah. So we really have to help our people not to get to this nocebo aspect.
Yes, we have a precautionary discussion.
Of course.
Voilà.
Again, have a very nice weekend, Alexandra.
Vielen Dank.
Yeah. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup.
Auf Wiedersehen.